Jim was assigned to Brazil. That love affair spurted a bit more, and I wound up marrying it. And I'm here to report, after 4 years, that it's been a very happy marriage. My real wife is back in Minnesota with our three little boys, trying to help them adjust to a new culture, or kind of a new culture, or at least a different culture, and learn to speak English, and get along with Grandma, and get ready for school. So I'm very sorry that Carol is not here with me tonight. Perhaps to begin, it might be interesting to, if I could talk with each one of you, to ask you what comes to your mind as you think of Brazil. Perhaps if you are addicted to late-night movies on television, you've seen some Tarzan movies and something like that, and that's your image of Brazil. That's wrong. There are places like that in Brazil, but not where we live. We live in a city of over 500,000 people, a very modern metropolis. My major problems as a missionary are traffic jams, red lights, and finding a parking place for my Brazilian-built Volkswagen. Of course, out in the country, when you travel between cities, there's the ever-present danger of being run over by a diesel truck or an interstate bus. But Brazil is a very modern and a very growing country. Brazilians don't like it when you refer to Brazil as an underdeveloped nation. They prefer that you refer to it as a developing nation. And I brought back with me, courtesy of the Navigator's Chamber of Commerce down there, a magazine, a Brazilian magazine, that gives a pictorial coverage of what Brazil is really like. And I'll have this with me down in the St. James Infirmary. after the meeting tonight, and maybe some of you, if you're really interested in Brazil, would like to take a look at it. I don't want it to get too far out of my sight because it's the only one I've got left. But this is something of what Brazil is like. Perhaps the second thing we need to do is to talk about the word missionary. My documents, my passport application, says that I'm a missionary. My alien residence card in Brazil says that I'm a missionary. And when I come home to the United States, I'm a missionary. But when you have an opportunity to meet for the first time a Brazilian student, and you want to make sure that you blow the opportunity and never let the friendship go beyond that first contact, there are two things that you can say to him. One is that you are an agent for the CIA and you would like to talk to him about his political ideas. The second thing that you could say to him, which would probably blow it, would be that you are a missionary with such and such a church or such and such missionary society. And in most cases, that would probably blow it too. So I say the same thing down there that I would on your campus or in your town. I'm a representative for the Navigators, which really doesn't say very much when you don't know what the Navigators are. Picture yourself in a city of 600,000 people, a new culture that you are trying to adapt yourself to and understand, a new language that you've just learned and you're trying to use without making too much of an idiot of yourself, and confronting one of the largest universities in a country. And incidentally, the university population of Brazil is not large. Out of 1,400 young people of university age, one Brazilian makes it through university. And this is the opportunity that you have before you. Where do you begin? You don't know anybody. You're not quite sure how to make the initial approach. Where do you begin? The first thing that we did was to pray. And we got some other people to pray. Jim came up with the idea, and I followed suit of drawing together just a small group of people who really knew how to pray, kind of Green Beret types, you know, and keeping in close touch with these people. Jim had a group of people, of 24 people, I believe it was, and I have a group of 14 people who have pledged themselves to pray daily for the work in Brazil. And so these were our kind of the people that supported us. I know there were a lot of you who were praying, but these Green Beret types were the real prayers. And whenever we got into a tight spot, I would call in some long-range artillery from our Green Beret prayers. And so we began to pray. The second thing we began to do was to go to the promises that God had given us, and which was the very reason why we were in Brazil. Two promises that God gave to Jim and I. This one in Isaiah 43:4, "Since thou wast precious in my sight, thou hast been honorable, and I have loved thee, therefore will I give men for thee and people for thy life." And then in Isaiah 45:13-14, "I have raised him up in righteousness, I will direct all his ways. He shall build my city. He shall let go my captives, not for price nor reward, saith the Lord of hosts. Thus saith the Lord, the labor of Egypt, the merchandise of Ethiopia, and of the Sabians, men of stature, shall come over unto thee, and they shall be thine. They shall come after thee in chains, they shall come over, and they shall fall down unto thee. They shall make supplication unto thee, saying, Surely God is in thee, and there is none else. There is no God." And as Jim and I began to pray those promises, I remember the first time that I was with Jim in Curitiba, where we are now located. We would pray those promises, and then we would get out and walk the streets and rub shoulders and look into the faces of young men that we wanted to win. And then God began to answer those promises and those prayers. And bit by bit, the doors began to open, and these men began to come unto us, just as that promise said. As God gave us these initial contacts and friendships, we considered each one as a possible fulfillment to each promise that He'd given us. So we treated each one with kid glove treatment, and we didn't waste any. And it's kind of like when you go out deer hunting, you're very careful, you're walking very quietly, and you've got the gun already and loaded, and every time a twig snaps, you jump, and you're ready to see if there's a deer coming out. And that's the way we were. Every time we went out under the streets, walking around students, we were waiting for that first twig to snap, and sometimes we had buck fever, you know, and we were a little bit too quick on the trigger. But God began to bring these people to us. And then it was a process of building friendship, and we spent a lot of time on this because a Brazilian has kind of a mistrust for Americans, and we were, all kidding aside, many times suspected of being CIA agents, and all the flap they had here a year or so ago in the U.S. about this thing didn't help any. And so we had to spend a lot of time going to concerts, going to soccer games, just standing around the street corners with guys, listening, and did a lot of listening and talking, answering questions, until that friendship just opened naturally into an opportunity to begin to witness and share Jesus Christ. These witnessing opportunities generally opened up either with a study in the Gospel of John, or a presentation of the bridge illustration. I think most of you probably have heard of the bridge. If not, you will before the week's over. And then going into the book of John, chapter by chapter, allowing a guy to become exposed to the basic Christian message. Many times this would take months. Some guys took up to a year. The average, I think, would probably be about 4 months of patiently going through this process until a guy was ready to make a real clean-cut decision for Jesus Christ. Now, maybe you say, why so long? Well, we ask the same question. What's wrong? Why is it taking so long? Well, there are a number of reasons for this, and if I started to give a complete rundown on them, you wouldn't get a chance to hear John here tonight. John's kind of the main course on the menu, and I'm just kind of the shrimp cocktail. But part of it is just the fact that there's just not a background of information. Brazilians have a lot of hang-ups on the difference between being religious and being a Christian. And the average Brazilian university student is up to here with religion, and he wants no more of it. And so you can't make waves because it's right up to here now. And so you've got to begin slowly exposing him to what it means to be a Christian. If I were to walk up to you in the street and ask you if you wanted to become a grapefruit, you would probably say, well, now, if you, you know, if you didn't have a quick temper and deck me with after the question, you would probably say, well, now, wait a minute. You're going to have to explain to me what you mean by becoming a grapefruit, because if it's what I'm thinking it is, I'm not interested. And this is the process that we have to go through of educating, of teaching, of instructing a man from the Scriptures what it really means to be a Christian and what's involved when Jesus Christ comes into his life. And almost involuntarily during this process, the man is exposed to our basic vision. And I can remember one fellow who was in the process of being evangelized who went with us on a weekend retreat. And in the course of a discussion following a Bible study that we did on this retreat, this fellow piped up and he said, well, is it possible for me to become a Christian and be quiet about it and not let anybody else know about it? So some of the other fellows in the group just piled onto him and he said, no, siree, if you become a Christian, you've got to let other people know about it. And the whole basis of being a Christian is that you're going to share it with other people and you're going to reach other people with the message of Jesus Christ. And it's not something you can keep to yourself. And I was kind of concerned because they just piled on top of this poor guy. But a couple of weeks later, he accepted the challenge and he's now one of our key men. So this is the reason why it takes so long. We now have in Brazil 11 what we call key fellows. Eight of these fellows are still in Curitiba with us. Three of these have already graduated and are now out in their professions. And we maintain our responsibility to those three just as if they were actually part of the original 11 back in Curitiba. Just to wind up and give you an idea of what happens, let me tell you the story of just one individual. When I first came to Curitiba after finishing language study, Jim was in contact with a fellow who ran a little language school where they taught English. And in order to get into contact with students, I did some substitute teaching at this language school. And one evening, one afternoon, this fellow who ran the language school dropped by and asked if I could substitute teach in a class that night. And I was planning to take my wife out to dinner that evening and just kind of spend a little quiet evening with my girlfriend. And I didn't like to stand her up, but at the same time, I knew that this was an opportunity. And so I said, well, I'll come and teach the class, but I'm going to bring my wife along. He said, oh, no problem. So Carol and I got all dressed up in our best bib and tucker, and we went out to dinner, and we just stopped off the language school for me to teach this class. And Carol and I walked into the classroom, and here, sitting around the room, were 15 engineering students. And, boy, I started drooling, you know, and it wasn't because I was hungry. It was kind of like walking into a shooting gallery with an M14. And after dinner, after class, we excused ourselves and went out for dinner, and we spent the whole evening talking about what an opportunity this was. And as we walked out of the classroom, this fellow who ran the school, he said, the teacher who was teaching this class can't teach it anymore. And he said, I need a substitute for about another month. Would you be interested? And I didn't pray about that. I said, yeah, I'll take it. So I spent a month with these fellows. And just in a very natural way, this initial friendship that I was talking about began. And in their English conversation with me, these initial barriers were broken down. And at the end of that month, I invited the fellows over to the home for some waffles. Waffles are kind of an unusual thing down there, and they thought it would be kind of fun. And that evening, as they were hanging around our home and listening to music on the tape recorder, one thing or another, one of the fellows that I had kind of had my eye on, you know, you're kind of looking, you know, walked over to the bookshelf, and he noticed a Bible there. And he said, is this your Bible? And I said, yeah. He said, do you read it? I said, yeah. He didn't know that, you know, what I did. He thought I was probably some businessman or something. He said, you know, I have a lot of questions about the Bible. And I said, oh, is that right? And he said, yeah. I said, I just can't find anybody who really has the time and really knows the scriptures to just to sit down and talk with me. And I said, well, you know, that's interesting because I'm very interested in studying the scriptures. In fact, I've got another buddy here in town that I study with, a fellow who's in your department, your fakuldaji, they call it. And I said, maybe you'd be interested in getting together with me, and we could just, you know, pick some place in the Bible and open it, and we could start reading. And he said, hey, that's a good idea. So I followed that contact up. And we got together after he got back from his vacation. They were going on winter vacation in the month of July down there. And when he got back from vacation, Jim and I got together with him. And Jim took about an hour and a half and made a presentation of the bridge illustration. And when he was all through, he said, okay, Nelson, what do you think? He says, well, I can accept that. But he said, you're going to have to take it kind of slow and easy with me. Because he said, I've got a lot of questions. That was in August. And so we started through the book of John, Nelson and I, sometimes two times a week, going at it 2 and 3 hours at a crack. And on October 22nd, Nelson gave his heart to Christ. The next year, school begins in March down there. It was his last year of engineering school, and we knew it was kind of go for broke in this last year with him. So I invited him to move into the home and live with us. And this proved to be a tremendous thing as he lived with us. And that was the year that Lauren Sanney came down and visited us with George Sanchez. And you know, this fellow Lauren Sanney is kind of good at recruiting people. And he didn't have much of a Portuguese vocabulary. I taught Lauren how to say about 12 words in Portuguese, and he did real well. But God used Lauren during that time that he was in Brazil to really touch Nelson's life. And after Lauren and George left the country, Nelson sat down with me and he said, you know, Ken, he said, you know that I'm engaged to this girl back home. And he said, living with you here these months in the home and then being able to talk and be with you while Sandy was here, he said, has convinced me that unless Gita, his fiance, unless Gita shares this way of life, was the expression he used, he said, I'll never be able to do God's will. And I said, well, I think you're right, Nelson. And I said, what do you have in mind? He said, well, we were going to get married in January after I graduate. But he said, I've been thinking about getting married in July and having her live with us here in Curitiba. And so she could just be around Carol and Marge and see what's going on. So I had kind of a funny feeling down in the pit of my stomach. I said, now, you're talking about getting married and living in Curitiba. Are you talking about living here in our home after you're married? And he said, well, that's what I was hoping you'd suggest. So I kind of gulped, and I didn't know if the navigator's ever done anything like this before, but I said, well, that might be the solution, Nelson. And I knew, here again, it was all or nothing. We either got this girl or we lost him. So I said, well, you go down and talk to Gita, and if she goes along with it, while you talk with her folks, I figured that'd kill it. Then we'll see what happens. So he grabbed a bus the next morning, cut classes, went home, came back a few days later and said, well, I'm kind of surprised. He said, Gita thought it was a great idea and so did her folks. So in July of that year, Carol and I were invited to participate in their wedding, which was quite a unique thing because a marriage is kind of a closed shop down there. And we were kind of like Nelson's best man and woman. They have a different situation down there, and we were their witnesses for their wedding. And then in August, why Nelson and Gita moved in with us. And my wife's just kind of a homebody type, you know, and she just began to love Gita, and it was a thrilling thing to see the way Gita, bit by bit, came to know Jesus Christ, kind of like Nelson had. And when they moved out to a little apartment after living with us for about 7 months, after they finished the move and I took them over to the apartment and helped them carry their last few things in, they stood at the door with tears running down their faces, thanking us for what God had done in their lives as a result of being in our home, seeing our kids, and just seeing us the way we really were. And Nelson is now teaching in a large vocational technical school in a town about 140 kilometers. That's about 85, 90 miles from us. And in a unique situation to begin to do what we want him to do. And this is the kind of thing that happens when we go through this kind of a process and get involved deeply in the life of just one individual. And this is the thing we need your prayers for. Thank you.